in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
Welcome to the Uncommon Communicator Podcast, where we bring enlightenment to the topic of communication. Are you ready to take ownership of your conversations? Are you looking to possess the skills to navigate and facilitate conversations to a mutual understanding? What are you waiting for? Grab your growth mindset and let's go! Welcome to the Uncommon Communicator. This week I'm so excited. I've got Megan Shapiro. Megan, we have met on the internet, which used to sound weird, didn't it? That was a weird thing. Now it's like, if you don't meet on the internet, then we never would have met. But we met through LinkedIn, and you had some posts about negotiation that really piqued my interest, because talking negotiation is the start of this podcast, as well as negotiation is communication. Negotiation is listening. So welcome. Why don't you introduce yourself? You'll do a better job than I can. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, James. Thanks for having me on. I'm Megan Shapiro. I am a full-time practicing construction attorney who recently decided that I wanted to pivot into proactive risk management, because I decided after litigating for 15 years or so and defending the same types of claims for my clients that, yeah, you know what, there's got to be a better way here. Maybe we should start taking some of these lessons that we've learned over this time, distill it down and implement some of this stuff on the front end so that we can avoid ending up in litigation at all. Or if we do, because of course litigation is inevitable sometimes, we will at least be in a better position to defend those claims. So I decided to sort of shift my focus, although I am still practicing full-time as an attorney, and I'm working on taking all of those lessons that I've learned. I have distilled them down into a framework, and I'm making an online course for construction leaders that is sort of universally applicable. It isn't state specific. It isn't trade specific. It isn't even subcontractor versus GC specific. And so everybody will have access to hopefully be able to use that framework and apply it in their businesses to have some proactive risk management strategies that will ultimately lead them to increasing their profits through doing that. And that's sort of what led me to my LinkedIn journey. And that is how we met.
I didn't know that's what led you to your LinkedIn journey. Well, that's exciting, because The whole side of litigation, I mean, we're, as a general contractor or anybody doing construction, there's risk, inherent risk. That's what we talk about on the safety side. But you know, there's so much on the contractual side as well, too. And I love the fact that we're risk managing, because we do that as a company as well, too, where we're always looking to mitigate those kind of risks. But to have a plan in place and then actually be proactive, I love that you're out helping the construction industry do that and avoid those lawsuits, because that's, you know, that's a fear of a lot of superintendents, is that at some point you're going to be, you know, held responsible for things that happen on your job site. So we want to do the best that we can to mitigate those risks. But absolutely, we're here to talk about mitigating risks. We're going to talk about negotiation, which is what? Mitigating risks. So one thing that, so you had a post recently about negotiation. Do you want to talk a little bit about what spurred you to have that conversation on LinkedIn?
Yeah, absolutely. So my approach to risk management is really holistic. It looks at a lot of different aspects of a construction company. It's not just contracts. It's not just on-site safety. It's sort of everything from a holistic approach. And a big part of that oftentimes can include negotiation. On the contract side specifically, you can mitigate and be proactive in terms of risk mitigation in the contract itself if you have a systemized approach to negotiating those contract terms on the front end. And I've sort of realized that there are a lot of skills that are oftentimes considered attorney skills, right? And negotiation tends to be one of those that aren't really attorney skills at all. Obviously, someone like you is a very skilled negotiator as well. Because there's this idea behind attorneys and negotiating and these sort of like high level concepts and words, I think it's intimidating for people, and they don't necessarily feel like they have the proper training or the proper skill set to really take on these roles. And that was what sort of led me down this path of merging the ideas of negotiation with construction. It started, actually, I was on a panel at the Sacramento Regional Builders Exchange, does an annual Women in Construction event in September every year. And I was on a panel, and I wrote my part of the panel presentation with the idea of imparting some negotiation strategies and skills to women in construction so that they could use them in negotiating their salaries, in negotiating projects that their project managers, superintendents, things like that. And so I had that presentation. And as I was diving deeper into my LinkedIn journey, I thought, ooh, you know what? I should share my presentation as a series. And so I did it over a week and I broke that whole presentation out into daily bite-sized pieces as daily posts on LinkedIn and then concluded it with a sort of wrap-up article. And I started it with a negotiation style quiz so that people could identify their own negotiation styles. And then I gave some tips and tricks on leveraging that knowledge of how you negotiate yourself and how you could use that to help you identify the negotiation style of the person you're negotiating against and leverage it to your advantage.
Yeah, it was a great, I mean, it was a fun ride that week, just seeing how much information that you were sharing. Like there's so much that can go into it. In some ways it's in its simplest form, at least I try to consolidate everything down to my tiny little mind. But the idea that it really does, a lot of negotiation comes down to actively listening. That's one thing that is really, you know, a key component in negotiation. But you're right, you nailed it, is that there are people who are not skilled at it, and it's just a practice. It's something that we can all learn, but knowing your style and then applying your style and knowing other people's styles, you know, those are things that you kind of covered through that as well too. Did you get, what kind of feedback did you get from that post?
You know, it was probably one of my most popular series. I've done a couple of those sort of week long series on different topics. And that one was probably the most popular and somewhat the most, I mean, controversial probably feels like a little bit too strong of a word, but I think actually you and I previously talked about, and I'm going to totally forget the name of the book so you can help me out, but Chris Voss has a book about negotiation style.
Yep. Never Split the Difference.
Right. Never Split the Difference. A lot of my style comes from getting to yes. And that book and the approach that book takes is definitely much more geared towards legal negotiations. And my understanding of Chris Voss's book is that it draws on his experience as a hostage negotiator. Is that right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's correct. In fact, I'm going through again. I'd listened to Getting to Yes before. I recognize the guy speaking this. So I've been going through that. And you're right. It's a different take. Everything has a different angle when it comes to negotiation and knowing how to apply it. Like I started this podcast on the whole, you know, on Chris Voss's book, Never Split the Difference. But what I've learned, and, you know, I had interviewed Sarah Ganella on the podcast, and, you know, some of the things that Chris says in hostage negotiation is no starts the negotiation. So it's a whole idea like we need to have, you know, conflict to negotiate. Now, this is a guy that's talking terrorists, you know, off of buildings with people. So it's a different, completely different take that he's applied to business. But the idea is that for any negotiation, there needs to be some kind of conflict going on, but that it was a different process. And I didn't realize until we had that conversation that empathetically, I'm like, holy cow, I have been going the wrong road with certain individuals who are kind of triggered her. And I completely understand it. Then that made me rethink how many other people have I triggered with that exact statement that, you know, no starts the negotiation. Those are his words, which are very true in that when we have a disagreement, it's like, okay, now we've got something to work on. But I didn't realize like in some people's stances, like no means no. So I really went on this really long journey of understanding this, what, you know, why is no mean no, but why does no start a negotiation? So it was really a great path for me to go down, a big learning path for me after working with her on it. And then when you were talking about that getting to yes, that's kind of that same thing. It's like, hold on a minute. No isn't always the best way to start a negotiation. Is that, so what's the best thing that you got from that book?
Yeah. So I think, and that's sort of what I was alluding to in a little bit of the controversy that came out of my post based off of Getting to Yes, is there are a huge amount of proponents of Chris Voss's book and approach. I also agree with Sarah. I hate the idea and I completely reject the premise that no is the beginning of a negotiation. It could potentially be because Sarah and I both come from the female perspective there. Mm-hmm. And obviously we're probably going to be pretty squarely in the camp of no means no, right? Yeah. And I think that there is a subtle distinction between no starts the negotiation and getting to yes ends the negotiation. And I think that comes into play when you really break down the difference between what the experience that Chris Voss is drawing on, clearly I'm not questioning his experience. What I am questioning is the application of his experience to a business context. I think getting to yes comes at it from a different angle that is a little bit more appropriate for business conversations and negotiations. I think, of course, you have to have some sort of disagreement to start a negotiation, or else there's nothing to negotiate about. But in business, the negotiation starts when everybody agrees that they've got a final goal and a final destination in mind. Nobody's starting with no. Everybody in a business conversation or negotiation is starting with not this, but.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Uh-huh. It's not no. No ends the conversation always. And as somebody who negotiates in mediations, in conversations with clients and opposing parties, ends the conversation every time. That's why when I'm the one that's in the position of turning down an offer, for example, I don't say no unless I mean no, we're done. This entire negotiation is over. That's why we have counteroffers, right? That's why it's a dialogue. It's a back and forth. Mm-hmm. And so I'm with Sarah, and I do think that there is a distinction to be made, and that's why I will firmly stand in the camp that getting to yes is a better business application of negotiation skills than never split the difference.
And I can see that. And it really was a deep journey for me too. Like I have this really long ride to this project that I'm on, and I went through this whole problem solving technique, like trying to identify like why, you know, this is a big issue. No means no, but why does no start the negotiation? And I really had to process through that. And what I came down to, and I want to toss this out your way, is I realized that for me, no, there's two types of no's. There's the no of dismissal. And I think that's the one for me. That's the person who you walk in their office and you're not listened to. They're like, no, get out of my office. I don't want to talk about it. Those type of no's of dismissal are the ones I'm very defensive about, because I've been there. I've heard some of them. And my whole thing now through this podcast, and I think it's my mission now, is to give people a voice. So the idea of no, you know, starts the negotiation is allowing me to help people get a voice in the no of dismissal. Now there's the no of refusal. That one is a no means no. Like if somebody says no, no means no. And that was like, I hadn't really processed the idea of no means no before. 100%. I'm in your court too. You're not just in with Sarah. Like we're all together on that. No, definitely means no. I think the perception of what I was giving was different in my mind, which is, you know, the no of dismissal. And that's, what are your thoughts on the no of dismissal and still allowing yourself the confidence to be able to ask some more questions, because you know, a lot of times people aren't hearing you, you know, you're not being heard. And how do you get your voice heard through that no?
You know, I think that's a really astute observation on your part and a very subtle distinction, but an important one. I would totally agree that there is a clear difference in how you can approach the no of dismissal versus the no of, I'm sorry, did you call it termination?
No, refusal. I made that
refusal,
up.
Refusal.
Trademark.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really important distinction for people to be aware of. That, and kudos to you for taking the time to parse that out and sort of identify where that disconnect comes from. I really love that. And I'm probably going to borrow it with credit to you. But yeah, I think in terms of strategies for dealing with the no of dismissal, as you're calling it, which again, I love, I think that is a lot more in line with, to take it back to the beginning of this, the sort of lawyer approach to negotiation. Because for example, for people who may not have had the good luck of being involved in a lawsuit, meaning the good luck of having not been involved in one, mediation is usually voluntary, that you're not required to do it. There will, in California anyway, there comes a point in time in the life of a case where the court will require you to attempt a settlement conference, but it is different than a mediation, which is voluntary. And so oftentimes when it comes to the point in the case where it might make sense to start those settlement negotiations, one party will be the one that reaches out and says, hey, do you think we should schedule a mediation? That is at everybody's own personal out-of-pocket cost. And there's this idea that maybe being the one that suggests it might indicate a weakness in the case. And so even the conversation about whether or not we should begin the negotiation is fraught with this idea of strategy and perception and all of those sorts of things. And so that a lot of times can be, as you're calling it, the sort of no of dismissal. And so the approach that I typically take in those types of situations is really softening the approach, right? Like, especially if I've got what I'm going to equate to your example of the boss who says, no, I don't want to talk about this, and slams the door in your face. For me, that's opposing counsel that, you know, gives the dismissive email response or the brisk tone in the phone call and slams the phone down. It's really about, that's when you have to get like really strategic about understanding your own negotiation style and doing your best to try to understand theirs. Because that's when we call it strategy, but really, let's be candid, it's manipulation. That's what it is. That's what all negotiation is. Let's just, I mean, come on, it's the elephant in the room, right? And so that's when the manipulation comes in. And so it's really playing to whatever the person on the other side of this needs to hear with, and disregard your own ego, because that's really what it comes down to. You have to, like, I have to be willing to look like the one that's weak in order to get what I want. And I think that really speaks to how you can approach the no of dismissal versus, you know, the sort of terminating no. And it's really about knowing, like I said, knowing your own style and knowing, doing your best to try to identify the style of the person that you're talking to so that you can get what you want out of it.
Well, and I've 100% avoided the word manipulation because I like the word strategy. I like the word negotiation, but there is some degree to that. But tell me more about how you would strategize. Like, what's the process in strategizing a negotiation?
You know, I wish I could give you a quick, pithy answer. That would be great for a clip that we could both use. But that kind of comes down to the heart of what Getting to Yes gets to and what my point is, which is you have to customize and tailor it based on your own style and based on your best determination of your opponent's style. Not to do like a plug, but that's really why my negotiation style quiz was my starting point, right? It was like, hey, if you're interested in this topic and you want to go on this week-long journey with me and potentially read the book at the end of this, start here. Because all of this is, each person is going to view the content in through a different lens based on what their own style is. And it's equally important to try to use those same strategies to try to identify the style of the person that you're talking to. Because not only do you have to know your own style so that you can make sure that you're managing it, you also have to tailor your approach to the other side based on what is going to be most effective to them. So I don't necessarily have a quick strategy beyond start with figuring out your own style and then do your best based on the information that you have from your interactions with the other side to figure out their style. And then you can go from there. Then I can give you strategies all day long, right? Then I can say, oh, you have this style, they have that style. This is what typically works. Try this. But without that sort of foundational information, it's really just sort of trial and error. And you're probably not going to have a very high success rate.
And you said trial. That makes people nervous when the lawyer says trial.
Different kind of trial. Different kind of trial.
I think you are there. I mean, I think what you're talking about is, and then I like to get things as simple strategy as you have. And I think you really did. You have it, whether you know it or not. You're like, it's as easy as it is complicated, because the idea is first knowing what your style is. And that's something that we do as part of the Uncommon Communicator. Is first, is it talks about enlightenment. I talk about knowing whether or not conversation is happening. This happens with negotiation too. You have to know that it's a two-way conversation. And so the moment of enlightenment is you're not getting what I'm saying, or we're not connecting. And sometimes we connect with people and it just happens. Other people, it's a lot of work. And I haven't, so it comes down to the next step is taking ownership of it, which again, in the negotiation setting, somebody has to take ownership of it. So I do enlightenment and ownership. And on the ownership side, the first thing that I do is look at my style, which I know what my style is, but I'm now looking at your style and know that, all right, you're an aggressive, all right, you're passive. You know, I look at those type of things. And from there, I've called it a combination. I've been looking for years to the key to communication. In fact, that's what started this with my boss. I'm like, I'm going to figure it out. And it's not a key. It's a combination lock. It's this and this and this and, you know, several different things like you're talking about to do that strategy. It's the same thing I do in kind of unlocking conversations, but it starts with understanding your style and their style, because sometimes they're never, just like you said, sometimes it's always going to go to trial. Sometimes they are just going to go that way. And that's the same with communication as well. Sometimes we're just not going to get past that point because we can't seem to connect those together. But that's, so you're there. You've already got strategy one. You can take that. You can take that to the bank. So, but in creating strategies, though, do you help people? We can kind of tie this to risk management. When you talk about helping people manage risk, are you also always a part of that working on developing their negotiation style or the communication style to help them mitigate that risk?
It certainly depends. I do when it's appropriate. And by that, what I mean, such a lawyer answer, right? It depends. This is why people hate lawyers. And I didn't even notice I was doing it, man. But it does. It depends. It certainly is a part of the course that I'm in the process of writing that will be coming out. And that's because that's a self-study, self-application sort of format of my framework. And so I want to empower people with the tools to be able to do that if they choose to, depending on the certain context. In the cases where I'm actually working directly with a client, whether that's as their attorney or if it's through the risk strategy consulting, in those cases, yeah, it's much more collaborative. It's really more, I hate the word coaching because I feel like it's been so diluted by so many other non-valuable sorts of things. So I hate the word coaching in that context. That's why I prefer strategizing. But it really is sort of like coaching them on helping them identify their own negotiation styles, helping them identify if they have a specific person on the other side that they are often negotiating with, or if it's this specific contract that they're negotiating in real time right now, if they know who that other side is, helping them sort of apply those things because it can be a little bit nuanced. It takes a little bit of practice to get good at it. And of course, we all have blinders when it comes to ourselves. I think there's nothing harder than a self-assessment, at least for me.
Yes.
And so, yeah, it's a little bit of handholding. I like that better than coaching, I think. It's a little bit of handholding to help them through that process and then really digging into true actual strategies. Once we've done that first step of identifying their style, their opponent's style, then we can really get down to the nuts and bolts, really get nitty gritty, map it out, game plan it out. And if I'm the attorney, I'm the one doing the negotiating most of the time. If they're negotiating a contract and it's not yet in conflict, then yeah, I'll give them the strategies. I've even gone so far as role-playing with them and saying, this is how I would say it if we were at the level of attorney involvement. We're not there yet. We're trying to prevent this from escalating to the point of needing attorneys. So this is how you can say it. Let's practice. I've done that with clients many, many, many times. So it really is a sort of hand-holding type of process, but always with the ultimate goal of empowering them to get to the point of not needing me. It's not a really great business model, either as an attorney or as a strategist consultant, but I really would love for people to never need me. I would love to be able to just like give them these tools so that they can do it themselves and not have to and not need me.
Well, and I think that's the best strategy. I know it sounds terrible and I was laughing because you're right. In some ways, you know, I'm trying to make, I think of that, the movie Liar Liar. Have you seen that with Jim Carrey? Yeah. Yeah. Where he's like, oh, my plan to eliminate myself is now complete when he gave the ball, you know, and anyway, so the whole idea is to, you know, work to eliminate yourself. But I think that's what makes you so valuable and what makes you set apart from other lawyers, from other business people and that's what I see a lot on LinkedIn as well too. People are giving away this stuff, which makes you more valuable to show the value that you have. It doesn't eliminate you because it's kind of like this, you know, I do a lot of cooking, a lot of barbecuing, and they're like, oh, is it your secret recipe? Can you share it? I'm like, no, I'll tell you everything that goes into it. You know, the whole secrecy of the recipe, that's not where the magic happens. I don't listen to those people. It's like, I got some secret ingredient. Well, then I'm not going to eat it. So it's just the whole idea of share your secret ingredients. It's going to make people want to, I don't know how I got off on a barbecue tangent. I haven't barbecued in months. I've been out of town. I haven't been barbecuing at all. But the one thing that you said, which was interesting, was talking about the whole idea of I just lost it.
I see so many interesting things, James. It's hard to keep track.
Well, so it's one thing is in forming a strategy. The one thing that I guess the big question that I've got with strategy is when you're helping people practice that stuff, right? That's a strategy as well too. And what I liked is especially you were or you were doing the role playing, which I got to tell you, like 5 years ago, it's like, no, thank you. I'm not putting on a Harry Potter hat. I'm not going to go role playing, you know, or whatever. That was always my picture. And until I got introduced to Chris Voss, Chris Voss actually came to our company and did a presentation on negotiation. Wow. That's what, yeah, I think it was expensive. He and his team came. It was great. But we started doing some role playing and everybody's uncomfortable doing that. But now I'd say, you know, 5 years later, I have completely seen the value of role playing and practicing and getting those skills and practicing those skills to become better at it, because that's really where you don't want, it's just like Toastmasters, like you want to practice before you go out into the real situation. And that's the same thing with negotiation. Let's, you know, sometimes saying those words seem uncomfortable the first time you say them, and then you want to practice them. Do you, as a lawyer, you role play court things as well, right? Do you do a lot of that type of practice role playing outside of just working with your clients?
Yeah. I guess I would maybe give it a different title. Role play, like, to me, role play is like a collaborative thing, right? Like, you're playing one role, I'm playing another role. Let's play this out together to see how this is going to unfold. I don't necessarily do a lot of that for myself for lawyering. I have different techniques that are sort of similar. So I will I don't do a lot of pre-written speeches. I'm better off the cuff. I always have been. I'm a trained speech person from way back. I started doing competitive speech and debate in eighth grade all the way through. So I know my own style. So I'm much better off the cuff. If I have a written out script, like word for word, it's terrible because I'm trying to remember every single word. I feel like I'm beholden to the script. But occasionally, and really, that's probably too generous. If I'm actually thinking about it, I can only really think of one time. One time when I was very early, it was for a mock trial competition in college. So this is pre-law school, pre-actually being an attorney, but it was a mock trial competition. And I was tasked with giving the opening statement as opposed to the closing argument. And the difference for this, for the purposes of your question, the difference matters. Because the opening statement is where you're laying out for the jury what is going to happen in the trial, as opposed to the closing argument, you now get to actually argue your case based on what actually did happen. And so closing arguments are by nature usually mostly unscripted and off the cuff. And that's where I'm more comfortable. That's what I typically did. I can't remember what the circumstances were as to why I was tasked with doing the opening statement, but because it was so far outside my comfort zone of how my normal style of delivery is, because it needed to be scripted, what I did was I wrote it out word for word, and then I recorded myself. I'm going to date myself here. Are you ready for this? I recorded it on a CD. Remember those CDs? Yeah, I recorded myself on a CD. And I listened to that CD in my car over and over and over again to help me memorize every single word so that I wouldn't stumble and I wouldn't get tripped up. So I guess in some ways it's a little bit of a role play, just in a little bit of a different flavor of role play maybe. And it did help. And I, you know what's so funny? That was 2004, I think it was, when I did that. And I can still recite the entire opening statement to this day. So it worked.
Yeah. So I'm not a huge fan of like memorize. I've done that before. I've memorized some speeches just as a practice. I've manuscripted them, which is another skill to be able to write like you're going to talk. And then I kind of did the speeches, you know, like a newscaster would. So there's different styles in learning to give messages and speeches. And I think I'm glad I went through that process, but I would never do it again either. There's a guy named Eric Edmedes. He's with Mind Valley, and he talks about how to be able to do storytelling. And it's a really great thing that I saw on YouTube, but he can talk for 5 minutes or he can talk for an hour with the same speech format that he has. So you'll have like three different topics. I don't do anything more than three because that's all my brain can memorize. So I don't need notes. And then you can either expand on it. But his whole thing is every time you tell that, you're using stories, which is probably a little different than your presentation. But what I like about being able to speak off the cuff still requires you to be organized. So you can do it and have your, like, if you had three main points that you're going to talk about, you know, I'm just making them up. You're going to talk about, you know, how you messed me up and how I got messed up and how we're going to resolve it. I don't know. I'm fake lawyering right now, but you have those three things, but then you have enough for you to make it, you know, sound personable. Cause I've heard people give written scripted speeches before and they're not natural, but to be able to have that, to think concisely, I think that's one of the most important thing in giving any presentation and honestly in communication. Like I know a couple of people that they are just conscious stream of thought people. And I'm like, I don't even know where we're going with this. And sometimes it's interesting. Other times it's like, you lost me. You know, it's just like, be a little, you know, more clear in this, and then also engage in the other listener. So there's people that don't do that. And I think in your position to be able to have and think clearly and concisely and have a message like that is something that's really important to do. So that's interesting that you memorize it and still know that speech. That's great. But then again, you'd never do it again, would you?
No, never. No, I would not. I'm glad I did it so that I could have that experience. Like you said, I know now that I have that tool to use if I ever wanted to, but no, I mean, it's not my natural style. I'm not best. I don't communicate best that way. I'm not effective. Well, I'm not as effective that way. And I'm certainly less persuasive that way. And as an attorney, of course, that's my number one job is to be persuasive. So yeah, it's not my preferred method at all.
And I think you lose the passion in it as well too. I don't think there's really anyone, and I know you say it's not your style, it's not mine either, but I don't think anyone that practices that style comes across as authentic either, because you lose that passion trying to get to the exact point. And having done it, like you, if you get lost in there, then you forget where you're going. And that's not the whole purpose of giving that message either. Because if you don't know where you're going, then nobody's going to care where you're at anyways. So one thing I did prior to this is I asked ChatGPT, because that's my go-to. I will say for ChatGPT, thinks like I think, which is scary because it is like the first time I used it, I'm like, I need to find out what's going on. This is when it came out, like I think last year or something like that. I still got the free version of it. And when I would punch things in, things come out in bullet points. I'm a bullet points person. I like to be concise. It puts things logically. So when it makes its messages, it's like how I think organized. So there's so much that I like about it, but also it loses a little, I couldn't just read it to you and you could think, oh yeah, James is talking here and the robot's talking. So anyway, I went in there like, what are the most important things when it comes to negotiation? And I thought this was interesting. The thing that came up was negotiation is communication. I didn't even feed it like in there. So it automatically said that, which is very true, but it came up with five things. I want to toss these your way and get your thoughts on it. But the number one thing, active listening. Number two, clarity and persuasion. Number three, questioning and clarification. Is that like a trial type setting? Empathy and understanding. And then the last thing would be negotiation language and tactics, where it talks about, you know, mastering specific negotiation, you know, language in how you're having that conversation, using the right words, anchoring, mirroring, which are all kind of Chris Voss kind of things that we're talking about, all, you know, help you enhance, you know, your abilities to be able to do that. But what do you think about ChatGPT's version of the five most important things in negotiation?
Well, again, in true attorney fashion, I have a question before I can give an answer, which is, I'm curious, did ChatGPT present those in that order of importance, or is this like a randomized list?
So I did not ask for, so let me take a look here. You know what? We're doing this live right now.
You may need to screen share with me too, because I wasn't taking notes. I already forgot most of them.
No, I'll go back. All I asked was, what are five? Hold on. No, here, I asked this question. I asked it a couple different ways. The number one, what is the number one skill to have as a negotiator? That was my pure question.
Okay.
And the response was, effective communication encompasses various aspects crucial to negotiation success, and then it numbered them. So I don't know that it put them in a specific order, but what I found with ChatGPT is it kind of does give a start and a finish type of you know, makeup to it. But the first one was active listening. Second one was clarity and persuasion.
Yeah. Okay. So I would throw active listening out entirely.
Really?
That might be surprising. Tell me more. Yeah. And I would start with, by the way, I think what was number four? I think number four is what I think is the most important.
Empathy and understanding. Empathy and understanding.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was. But I would throw out active listening entirely. And that my giant asterisk caveat to that is that could my position on that could be informed by the fact that most of my negotiation is done in a mediation setting through a third party mediator. So I don't need to actively listen. I don't have to. I don't really even have the opportunity to very often because I'm communicating with the mediator what I want and need. The mediator is then communicating that to the other side and then coming back to me relaying what they said. And so there isn't really too much of active listening that goes on there. If I were to take my lawyer hat off and just put on, like, I don't know, my wife hat or my employer hat or something, you know, a different hat that required me to negotiate in a different context, then sure, active listening might make the list, but it definitely would not be my number one. It wouldn't be top of mind at all.
Okay. Well, and that's, let me just read the wording. So it says, understanding the needs, interests, and concerns of the other party through attentive listening helps build rapport and demonstrates respect. But I can completely see where you're coming from in regards to the current situations you work under. Like you're beyond this active listening. Like you're in a mediation format. But I do think that's really one of the keys, I think, in any communication is to shut up and listen. Like so many people just start talking before they. I know two individuals currently who make assumptions about what I'm thinking and going to say. And instead of actually hearing, they hear what they want to hear. But I can completely see that. The next one was clarity and persuasion.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of both of those. Clarity would probably actually be my number one because if you don't understand your own goals and understand at least to the best of your ability based on the information that's available to you what the goals of the other side are, then it's a non-starter. There's no conversation to even have. You can't even get to negotiating because you aren't even in a conversation at that point, particularly in terms of identifying your own goals, right? So clarity, I think, would probably be what I would put number one. Again, I forgot all of those, but I would definitely put clarity very, very high, probably number one. And then what was the other part of that? I forgot.
Persuasion, clarity and persuasion.
Yeah, I would probably put persuasion last because I think all the rest of that stuff comes before you get to the part of being persuasive and contributes to your ability to be the most persuasive. So I think it starts with clarity and ends with persuasion. That's what I'm sticking with now until you tell me another one, and then I'm probably going to change my mind.
I'm loving that. I had no intention of putting you on trial, and I feel your power right now. This is amazing. So the next one was questioning and clarification.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of redundant, I think, right? With clarity, ChatGPT, it's okay. I'll give them a pass. I like ChatGPT too, but they're not great. It's not perfect. Like people. But yeah, I mean, certainly I think asking questions is the best way to clarify, at least for the other side's intentions, and maybe asking questions of yourself to make sure you can identify your own goals. I guess this might be a really good place to throw in the idea of BATNA and WATNA, which again comes directly from getting to yes, which is figuring out the other side's best alternative to a negotiated agreement and their worst alternative to a negotiated agreement. Similarly, it's equally important to figure out those two things for yourself. It really helps you get clear on what you're willing to accept as a settlement, as an agreement, as a part of the negotiation. And knowing what that is for your opponent also gives you a lot of clarity because it gives you a little bit more leverage. You can tailor your approach a little bit better if you know what their best alternative is and then what their worst alternative is, because it helps you, it gives you kind of pain points that you can push on really.
Yeah. I think questioning really is the key. One of the things that caught me with this, and you're right, there's always redundancy. It's almost like they're getting paid by the word, but the one thing that in this one in particular, it talks about asking relevant questions and seeking clarification when needed helps ensure mutual understanding. And that's really one of the tenets of the Uncommon Communicator, is to work all conversations to a mutual understanding. So that word caught me. I'm like, all right, I think the robots are listening. They're giving me what I want to hear. But the idea of questioning and clarification, just so we can both know exactly that we're talking about the same thing. So I really love that portion of it, but there is a little redundancy. Empathy and understanding.
I do want to go back for 1 second because I want to add one more thing to follow up on what you just said, which is
rebuttal.
As attorneys, one of the number one things that we're concerned about, not just in negotiating, but in everything related to what we do, is making sure that we're all using the common definitions of the word. Like we have a common definition, right? Because there's nothing worse than having a complete miscommunication where you're talking past each other because you have not taken the time to make sure that you share a common definition of a word. And that's even more amplified in the context of negotiating. Because if you are talking about one thing and using a word to describe it, and the other side hears that word and has a completely different meaning that they associate with that word, you could be shooting yourself in the foot, getting to a place where you're at no, or stopping the negotiation. And there's no reason for that. I think a great example of this, I took a 40-hour mediator training at Northwestern that used getting to yes as the textbook. And one of the lessons that we did in that course was a mock negotiation. And it was so powerful because, of course, in mock negotiations, the way those are set up is like, I've got my packet of confidential information. The person I'm negotiating against has their packet of confidential information. Of course, I don't know what they know and they don't know what I know, to set it up to make it as real as possible. And there was kind of a key in there to get to a mutually satisfactory settlement and agreement. And it was, the idea behind it was, I needed the orange peels for something, right? It doesn't matter what it was, but I needed orange peels. My opponent needed orange seeds, but we didn't know that tiny distinction. So we were fighting over who gets the oranges. Of course, the key was communicating enough and defining the terms enough to realize by asking clarifying questions, to your point, James, and to ChatGPT's point, of getting to the point of negotiating and communicating well enough where I say, where I finally ask a question that leads you to say, I need the orange seeds. And I say, oh, well, I only need the peels. So why don't we just split it that way? I'll give you all the seeds, you give me all the peels, and we're both happy. And so I think that really struck a chord with me when I experienced it in that lesson. I happened to be one of the couplings of or pairings of groups that actually was able to figure that out. And so we found they found the solution, but most people didn't. And I think that goes to show the power of questions and the importance of reminding people about the power of questions.
Yeah, that's a great story. I actually use the story of the orange when I talk about conflict management, conflict resolution, which are two different things. And I've used that story of the orange, and I'll bring in the audience. Like, I'll say, hey, John, you're over there. You know, we're both fighting over this orange. And it's like, no, I can't split. They'll say split in half, and I can't do that. And then so I take that whole scenario, just a story that I tell where you go into this up, you know, and it was just going to this, somebody else takes it in one-on-one, brings them in, asks them some questions, and they come out and they do just that. Like in the case of the story that I use, somebody needed the pulp because I make up some story about they need the vitamin C because they're going to get scurvy, which probably half the audience don't even know what scurvy is. And then the other person needs the orange peel because they're making this orange, you know, cupcakes or something like that. All they needed was the peel. I didn't realize that this was a story that went deeper, but it really, like I've had people go, wow, like I hadn't thought about the concept of we can both win with what, because we haven't talked about what we need. So that's pretty neat that I don't know where I stole that from. It wasn't ChatGPT, but the internet definitely gave that one to me. So that's pretty neat. So questioning clarification, any other comments or rebuttals before we move on?
No, I think I'm ready for empathy and something else. It was paired with something.
Yeah, empathy and understanding.
Okay, yeah. Definitely understanding, I agree with, but I think that still is a little bit redundant with clarity. I would couple it back to the importance of defining our terms, right? I would define understanding as understanding their motives, which would go into the clarity bucket for me. And that's why I would parse out understanding from empathy. I personally don't agree that you have to be empathetic to be able to be successful at negotiating. In fact, as an attorney, I think it can actually hurt you. And the reason why I say that is because negotiations in the legal context can be, and a lot of other contexts too, particularly like an employer-employee situation, it's fraught with emotion, right? That's honestly probably the biggest value that an attorney actually brings. It's not our training in negotiating. It's our ability to not be affected by the emotionality of this, of the conflict and the situation, right? And so I think in situations, and I've had mediations like this, and I think the mediators are probably just new or inexperienced or untrained, but I've had mediators put my clients in the situation where they had tried to get them to empathize with the other side, and it backfires 100% of the time. They're not in an emotional state to be able to say, I can see where the other side is coming from, because if they could, we wouldn't have gotten to this. We wouldn't have gotten this far in the conflict in the first place. We would have already been able to find a resolution and settle it, right? So I don't agree that empathy is required at all. And I would probably argue that empathy could in some negotiation settings and contexts do more harm than good. I mean, I've had clients walk out of a mediation entirely because a mediator has tried to get them to empathize with the other side who they felt very, very wronged by. And so, yeah, I would throw empathy out entirely, mm-hmm. personally.
And empathy, sympathy, those are, I mean, that's a slippery slope, I think. I think it is hard to understand, especially, you know, I come from a point where I'm just now finding that I have some inkling of vulnerability in there. I mean, it's just things that I'm learning, I'm growing from, finally learning about that. Prior to that, you know, I just didn't have response. I didn't have emotion, you know, all these things that I'm developing, right? I'm starting to live life. But the idea of empathy, from my perspective, though, is really understanding the situation from the other person's shoes. It's not necessarily filled with emotion, but it's understanding it from their position. So you can so when I understand how they're coming from, and a lot of that doesn't get there, I don't think, unless you can ask questions to know, see it from their perspective necessarily. But I can completely see where it can muddy things up when you see it from an empathetic standpoint. But and I would agree with you on the understanding, and you nailed it. They said understanding their motives and constraints allows you to tailor your communication approach and proposals accordingly. So understanding is important in there, and empathy is interesting how it can muddy up the waters. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, I think so. And again, I mean, I think it's contextual. I definitely think it's contextual. If it's a pure business dispute and emotions are not really involved, then it might not be bad, but I also think there's less of an opportunity to be empathetic in a true, pure business dispute, because like it's just about numbers, right? At that point, it's a business decision.
Completely. And that's, I think, one of the hardest things to navigate through in any negotiation is the emotions. And I'm always looking at the detachment perspective. You know, how can you detach yourself from this to really understand all of the facts that are in there? Because emotion is going to drive you in a way that isn't going to resolve to the best resolution. As well as if you're working with somebody who is filled with emotion, you know, at that point, you either need to figure out a way to get the emotion out of it or step away and come back. Because really negotiating in an emotionally tense situation, in my opinion, does not get to the resolution that you're going to get to as long as there's emotions in there. But understanding why there are emotions coming in there might help, you know, understand that, or it might help that individual yourself realize, holy cow, I'm getting a little fired up here. Yeah. You know, maybe I need to detach my emotions from it a little bit better to look at the facts. So that's a tough challenge, I think. And you, as being a lawyer, bet.
Oh, sorry, James. I think we froze there a little bit.
We did. I saw that. I hope I don't edit, by the way, so everybody's going to hear all that. But I would assume that you work in and around emotions quite a bit, being in the lawyering field. Is that right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think I alluded to it a second ago when we were talking about this a little bit, but I do think that that truly can be one of the most powerful things that an attorney can bring to a negotiation on behalf of a client, is both our ability to not be attached to the emotion of the situation, but also we are most of the time, if you're doing it right, in a trusting relationship with your own client. And so you can have those hard conversations confidentially with your client in a loving is not the right word, obviously, to describe the relationship between an attorney and a client, but in a more positive way where you can sort of make, honestly, sometimes the same arguments that the other side is making, but you can do it in a way that in the context of that trusting relationship between attorney and client, you can present it in a way that gets them to sort of look at it from a little bit of a different perspective and let the emotional sort of shield down a little bit so that they can see it maybe a little bit more clearly, see it through the lens of the attorney and take a step back from that emotionality and really look at it as a business decision in terms of, yes, maybe you were completely wronged here. Like, you might be morally 100% right, but how much do you want to spend to prove that you are morally 100% right? How much emotional taxing do you want to put yourself through to continue on through this dispute as opposed to cauterizing the wound and stopping the bleeding now? Because I think not to derail this too much off of the idea of negotiations, but I think oftentimes a lot of clients underestimate the emotional toll that being involved in litigation will take. It is long, it is taxing, it is draining. And I think clients don't fully appreciate what that is going to be like until they're in it. And sometimes they want to take an early off ramp because they can't handle it. And sometimes they stay in it too long that now there is no off ramp and now they're stuck. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of the role of the attorney to negotiate with their own client sometimes to get them to sort of look at that and see and properly value the different pieces of that equation.
Yeah, that's something that I talk about in like conflict and resolution and management also is the idea of, of trying to draw out that emotion first, because, you know, you get it pent up inside. And I've personally resolved conflict on a job site by just letting somebody talk. And then, cause they had something against me. I'm like, all right, Joe, like, what's going on here? And he's like, I'm having a hard time with this and, you know, this. And then it's like, I'm having a problem at home. And he's like, that's not you, but it was me up until he was able to admit that. And I think that's part of that's a negotiation part as well too, is letting people feel those emotions. But I see your point though, like to let people know ahead of time how emotionally taxing it's going to be. You have to be built for it, or you have to be able to come to a point where you can separate it. If you don't, it's just going to grind you up and spit you out. So yeah, that's absolutely interesting.
And you know, everybody has heard attorney at law. Not as many people have heard counselor at law, but it is a dual role. And we actually talk about it in law school. They have a whole portion. It's not its own class, but there's a whole portion of a class where they talk about the duties and responsibilities of being a counselor at law, which is that sort of emotional side of managing your own clients and the relationship and the burden. It really can be a burden on the attorney because there's a shift, right? The clients will rely on us in a way that puts a lot on us, less so in the business world if your clients are businesses, but certainly if your clients are individuals in individual disputes, there can be a lot of a burden shift that goes from client to attorney just by virtue of the relationship. And so being a counselor at law has its own whole set of considerations and preparations and negotiations and communications that go along with that, with your own client. Certainly.
I've never heard that. I've heard the term counselor, you know, just, I've watched a lot of TV court shows and I never tied it to an actual be a counselor at law. That's what you are. You become counsel. That's another word for it as well, too. I love that tie verbally to what that is. That's interesting. Yeah, I like that. So the last one we already kind of talked about, negotiation, language, and tactics. We talked about how it's important to have the right wording, and I think you agree on that one there. So
yeah,
we will say that GPT gets what, like a C-, maybe? Is that what we're giving it?
Yeah, I think before I grade ChatGPT, I want to correct one thing because I told you I didn't remember all five in a row. I actually think I would put number five as number one, and here's why. I think having your tactics and your strategy ahead of time is absolutely key. If I don't have a plan for my negotiation before I walk in the door, a week before the mediation, having already sat down with my client and gone over it, then I'm already starting from behind. So I would actually put strategy as number one. So I want to clarify that. And then I would grade ChatGPT. I would probably give ChatGPT, I'll go C plus. I'll give them a C plus.
Okay. We'll give them a C plus on this one. The information was there, just needed some correcting in its order. And then also, I'm a big simplistic guy. I do find it a lot. I'm like, that third point's the same as a set. Are you just filling points in here? So there's a lot of redundancy, but sometimes communication needs some redundancy so people have an opportunity to hear what you're saying.
Right.
So, Megan, this has been absolutely a lot of fun. I wanted to end with a quote here, and we could talk about that, and then we can go in some other specifics. But this is a quote from Marcus Aurelius. He says, "The problem creates the solution. What stands in the way becomes the way." And with that, the idea is, you know, oftentimes confronted with, I think I froze there for a minute, huh? A lot of times, yes. Did you catch that quote?
I heard the quote.
Okay. So the idea is that people get kind of just confronted with negotiation or a conflict, and they're like, well, you know, it's, what do I do? But the idea is, it is the way. If you can work through that, then everybody's going to be better on both parts. Do you think that's is that fitting for a negotiation podcast to mention that quote? What do you think of that?
Yeah, I do. I think, I don't think that's necessarily always the best outcome. And this probably brings it full circle back to no. I disagree that no is the start of communication or of a negotiation. I do think that there are some things that should not be negotiated through. And the right course for everybody is to walk away. But I think that that's probably the exception that proves the rule. So certainly I would agree that most of the time, I would agree with Marcus Aurelius. Yeah.
Most
of the time. Again, true lawyer response, right?
Well, I got to tell you this is what I've most enjoyed about this conversation. I work with a lot of people who are, you know, you got to only ask open-ended questions. They're fixed on that. In fact, there's this thing that we do where we go through a practice and an observer is watching the other person who's the coach. And if the coach, you know, doesn't ask only open-ended questions, they get kind of a violation. But there, I've asked purposely yes and no questions from you, and you've always filled in the blanks. And I mean, because it's just to prove a point that you can. It's okay to ask yes or no questions and get more information. But that's just made this completely pleasurable for me. Appreciate it. I always end.
Tell me, I was the subject of an experiment, James.
I didn't know until I was halfway through. When I caught myself, I'm like, I keep asking these yes questions, and Megan just fills them in with such great information. So I was dinging, myself, and I'm like, wait a minute, this is working. So I had no idea. So this one's for Adam Hoots. I'm gonna share that with him. That yes question and no question does work. But I always sum up all of our podcasts with the UC moment. It's the uncommon communicator moment that we know. We sum it up. You know, we've been talking for an hour. Like, what can people who have listened to this walk away with in, say, you know, a one or two sentence statement?
About negotiation specifically, I assume?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I would say number one, take the time to identify your own negotiation style. If you do nothing else, if you take away nothing else from this podcast or from my series or from the books, identify your own negotiation style. Absolutely. If you need help, I will link my quiz. When James publishes this podcast, I'll link my quiz in the comments. I think you'll probably publish it to LinkedIn, James. So I'll link my quiz. But whether you do it that way or not, take your time to identify your own negotiation style. It will be invaluable to you in terms of getting to know yourself better. Mm-hmm. It goes beyond just negotiation. It helps you identify your own communication style, really. And it will help you in every conversation that you have, not just, again, in conflict-based negotiations. It'll help you in conversations with your partner. It'll help you in conversations with your kids, your parents. It's just, it's valuable information to have about your own personality. So that would be my number one takeaway.
I love that. And so how can people, and yes, we will post it on LinkedIn. We're also on YouTube. Those are the places that we will be sharing this podcast, as well as all the podcast directories as well too. Without video, we will be posting video. But how can folks get a hold of you, and what other things are you working on?
So I am working on the online course that we talked about at the beginning. It is set for a release on April 1st. I'm happy to offer a special discount code to your listeners if they want to enroll on the wait list. So I can drop that link as well in the comments. I'll provide your listeners with a discount code to join the waitlist early. It'll be released on April 1st. I have two live streams a month that I do. My next one is going to be Tuesday. I don't know if this is going to publish before then, but it's going to be Tuesday, March 12th, not going to publish, but you can catch the replay. It's on YouTube. That one's called The Neighborhood Coffee Shop with Josh Lubker and John Goose Dunham. I also have my podcast, Risk to Revenue, the streaming sessions. The next episode of that will be April 1st with Megan Spivey. We'll be talking all about construction contracts. I am organizing an in-person gathering for anybody who wants to come. I did get a DM asking if somebody said, I'm not technically in the construction industry, but I still want to come. Is that okay? Absolutely. Everybody can come. So we're going to be meeting up in person in Savannah, Georgia, the last weekend in September. I post about it every Saturday on LinkedIn, hashtag Savannah Saturdays. The other hashtag is hashtag Savannah in September, if you want to follow that. I also have an email list for that specifically so that you don't miss out on any of the details and information if you want to join. On that note, where you can find me, I am on LinkedIn at Construction Risk Strategist, Megan Shapiro at Construction Risk Strategist. I'm on Instagram as at Construction Risk Strategist, Facebook at Construction Risk Strategist. You can find me on my website. It is very simple. It's meganshapiro.com. My email address is equally simple. It's Megan at meganshapiro.com. Megan is M-E-G-A-N. I know it's on the screen, but for the listeners of the audio-only podcast, Megan is M-E-G-A-N-S-H-A-P-I-R-O. So I'm actually pretty easy to find, and that's what I've got going on. It's all exciting stuff.
How did you even find time to come on the Uncommon Communicator podcast? I don't even know. Thanks so much, Megan, for being
time for you.
I love this. I so appreciate you being on. This has been a lot of fun, very informational. And the UC moment being know your negotiation style. I love that. It's short. It's simple. That's all we've got. See you. Bye.